Morning. How are you all? Good morning. Dick's interrupting me. What do you want?
I just want a short word with the congregation. Just take a minute.
Dick wants a word with the congregation. All right.
Sorry, Scott. I just want to have a brief word. The first time anyone says this word, it always sounds atrocious. If it just rolls right off your tongue, you're clever and precocious. I would say the proper way is learn it by osmosis. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Let's try to get the rhythm with collective symbiosis. Train your tongue to go just so would be my diagnosis. Multiple syllabic, both flamboyant and ferocious. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. 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 Hopefully the repetition won't overexpose us. Nice and slow, just one more go before Scott interposes. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
Well, that was a very fine word. Thank you. All right, well, now, welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. Where we all gather together from different walks of life with different beliefs, we join in community to share our spiritual and intellectual journeys together for a better world. I'm Scott Zanona, past chair of the fellowship here, and before we begin, I want to draw your attention slightly out of order to the announcements in the order of service over on your right. And now, go ahead and turn to your neighbor, please. Say good morning. Say hello. Share a word. It could be that long word, or it could be a different one. Thank you. Thank you. How many people said supercalifragilisticexpialidocious to their neighbor? No one? Wow. All right. So if you're new here, you should know that our services are quite varied. Sometimes they're minister-led, sometimes they're lay-led, and they range from tightly focused intellectual explorations of particular religious or ethical topics to, well, the kind of mayhem you're experiencing today. As Unitarian Universalists, we draw from many sources of wisdom. We turn to the best scientific understanding of the natural world and human psychology, as well as old texts that still carry insight into the human condition. The Unitarian Universalist movement we are a part of has roots in Christian tradition, but also draws from world religions, including mystical and nature-based views, as well as secular understandings of social justice and charity and humanist respect for our own abilities to reason, to discover truths, and to determine our own values. That Unitarian Universalists draw from such varied sources is a great strength, but sometimes some of that strength comes only by first introducing some tensions between approaches, sometimes between and within the same individual. Our community includes people on a spectrum from committed theists to those who believe that belief in God is a sort of childhood crutch that should be best abandoned. From those for whom spiritual is an empty word, to those who embrace the supernatural. Today, we're talking about magic. And I'm going to be joined by Dick, his wife Sylvia, and Jennifer Bryan over here, who are going to talk to us a little bit about what they think about magical thinking. Before I got married, my wife Kathleen made me promise that I would not ruin the magic of rainbows and the mystery of the blue sky for our kids by explaining them away. I don't know why she was so worried about this, but, you know, apparently there's something about my character, all right? Now, understanding the physics of light scattering, I mean, to me, just makes me more amazed about these phenomena. But I also understand, you know, that there's something valuable that can be lost when we think we understand something. So I light our chalice today in the name of that ineffable something. We have no announcements. I've done them, so we're going to sing.
Free your mind from judgment, free your heart from fear. Releasing expectations, bringing spirit here. Free your mind from judgment, free your heart from fear. Releasing expectations, bringing spirit here. Free your mind from judgment, free your heart from fear. Releasing expectations, bringing spirit here.
Communities provide us support in difficult times and help us celebrate joyous occasions. We're a community that supports and celebrates together on Sunday mornings. Please share, if you want, your joys and sorrows. There's a mic that will come around.
I'm substituting for Kathleen, old father, who's on her way back to Manhattan as caring chair. I have seen Buddy McGoy. He is smiling. He is in good mood. He is recovering from a stroke, and he has these things to share with you. One is that he can walk or chew gum, but not both simultaneously. And the therapists who work with him are sadists.
I have a wiggly tooth, and it's about to come out.
Excellent. That's exciting.
This past week, we were offered to do a 10-mile race, and it's the first time I've ever done a 10-mile race. This past week, we were offered to do a 10-mile race. I've never done one of those before, and I completed it in less than an hour and a half, and it was the first time I ran 10 miles. I'm still suffering, but I decided it was a good idea.
Excellent.
Hi. My family were happy and relieved that my grandson was assigned to go to Stennis Space Center. Mm. He's in the Navy, and it was a big relief.
Good.
I'm Harriet Yonke, and I want to thank all of you who gave me expressions of care and concern with the death of my husband. And I really think being a UU made it easier. I was with other friends that were more conservative Christians, and they were praying for this and praying for that, and somebody died even though they'd prayed for them. And I just felt like I had nobody to blame. It's just the way nature is. You got chronic lymphatic leukemia. It's going to get you sooner or later. And other illnesses, that's what's on this earth, and you just have to accept there's going to be an end when none of us live forever. So.
Sarah Hoyt, I have what is, I think you'll understand, both sort of a sorrow and a joy that after a 7-year battle with Alzheimer's, my father-in-law passed, and we're going to the memorial service in Boston next week. Sorry.
Thank you all for sharing, for those joys and concerns, both said and unsaid. We hold them in your hearts. So I know many of our kids are off canoeing right now, and some of our adults are with them, but we still have some kids and some kids at heart here, so if you want to come on up, we're going to have a story for all ages.
Thanks for coming up. Don't be shy. I won't bite. Till later. Well, have you ever wished you were magic?
Yes.
See? You can admit it. Did you ever think you might, maybe you were magic? No? Okay. One person admits it. Well, when I was born, my dad planted a little apple tree for me that he had started from a little seed. And from when I was really tiny, as long back as I can remember, I liked to sit under my tree and sing to it. And I would sing, my apple tree grows big and tall just for me. And then I would sing, my apple tree grows so tall, it's the prettiest tree of them all. Well, the adults thought that was so cute, a little girl singing to her apple tree, and they teased me and they said, well, you must be magic because your tree is growing so big and tall. It must be your magic singing. And I thought, I think I am magic. My tree is really beautiful, and it was covered with apples by the time I was about 4 or 5 years old. I am magic. Well, how do you guys get to school? Do you walk or ride your bikes or a bus? Well, in the neighborhood I grew up in, there was no school bus. And I can't think of a single family that had more than one car. And back in the dark ages when I was a little kid, all the dads went to work and took the car. So the moms didn't have any cars. So we all walked. And my friend Marley Hafner and I, we had a walk. It took us a little bit over a half an hour to get to kindergarten and a little bit over a half an hour to get home, but it's partly because we walked really slow. But one day I went to school, and I was really happy because it was drizzling, and I got to take my new umbrella, and no one in my whole family had an umbrella. I was the first one, and it was so pretty. The cloth part was blue and red striped and had little silver threads going through it. And the best part, it had a wooden handle, and on the end was a blue plastic, clear plastic blue knob in the shape of Donald Duck. And if you held it up to the light and looked through it, it looked like the whole world was blue. And I sort of thought, that is really magic. Yeah?
It's
Mickey Mouse too.
There's something very mysterious about shadows. He saw a shadow that was like Mickey Mouse. Was it on your wall? No.
It was on the light.
Oh, on the light. Oh, huh. That's neat. Well, anyway, so it was drizzling, and then I got to take my umbrella to school, and I sort of wanted to show it off because I was really proud of it. And when I got to kindergarten, all my friends thought it was really cool. They all wanted to hold it. But when I was walking home with my friend Marley, we were just walking along, blabbing our heads off, and we heard some footsteps coming up fast behind us. And we looked back, and oh no, it was the Mean Simon twins, Jerry and Gary. And they looked exactly alike, and their mother always dressed them exactly alike, so nobody knew which one was which. And one of them was mean, and one of them was nice, but when one of them did something mean, he always said it was the other one. And then the one who didn't do it said it was the other one. So no one ever got to the bottom of who did anything bad. So we were scared, and they started to chase us, and they said, the mean one, I guess, said, I want your umbrella. Well, I was not going to let him have my umbrella. So we started to run and run, and he chased me all the way to my yard. And then I got this idea, and I tossed my umbrella up into my apple tree, and I sang, higher high, higher high, apple tree, take my umbrella up into the sky. And I thought then he couldn't get it. But I guess my tree couldn't grow fast enough, or wasn't my song magic? I don't know. But the mean Simon twin grabbed it out of the branches of the tree, and he cracked it over his knee, and he bent its ribs, and he threw it on the ground, and he and his brother went home laughing. But I went home crying. My umbrella lay there on the ground like a dead bird. And I went home, and I was crying, and of course I told my mother, and she called Mrs. Simon. So that night, Mr. Simon came to our house with Jerry and Gary, who were still arguing about who had broken the umbrella. And so no one ever knew which one broke my umbrella. Their father offered to buy me a new umbrella. I remember him taking some dollar bills out of his pocket and handing them to my dad. But my dad said, no, that's okay. And I was kind of disappointed because I thought maybe I could get a new umbrella. But anyway, I really wasn't all that sad because my dad took a saw and he sawed off the wooden handle, the wooden part of my umbrella, so that I had the little clear blue plastic Donald Duck. And now I could put it on my window in my bedroom. And something really magical did happen because as the sun moved across the sky during the day, it made a blue shadow on the wall in my bedroom that moved across the wall, and that really did seem like magic. And that's the story. So when you go through your days, look for magical things because they can just make you feel happy and make sad experience seem not so bad. Thanks for listening to my story.
We will now receive the morning's offering. Life is a series of decisions. Little ones, like, do I want iced tea or lemonade? Big ones, like, what do I believe? Psychologists, economists, philosophers have theories about how decisions get made and how they ought to get made. An amazing thing about the study of reasoning, to me, is that we can actually prove or empirically discover facts about good reasoning methods, but only given certain background goals and conditions. No one has an answer to what the proper decision is in any situation, except with respect to the available options, possible outcomes, and the preferences of the person making the decision or assessing the decision. Rationality can tell you to do this or do that, if your goals are this or if your goals are that, but they can't just tell you to do something, period. It's this sense of answering what reasoning methods can accomplish, given your goals, even though there are many different kinds of reasoning. It's this sense that it allows us to say what is rational. If you don't mind getting wet and hate carrying an umbrella, just lost my place, sorry. Ah, there we go. And hate carrying around extra things, yeah, then it might make sense for you to not carry an umbrella. But if you care a lot more about not getting wet, then you care about the annoyance of carrying something else around, and there's a good chance it's going to rain, and you're not an incurable optimist that just prefers to hope for the best, all right? Well, then we might be able to say it's irrational for you to deliberately leave your umbrella at home, if those are the conditions, yeah? I can give a similar account for why somebody should reason logically. Right? There are, in fact, many different sets, different kinds and extensions of logic. So why should we follow standard logic, the kind I teach in intro and mid-level courses? Well, I can say that it preserves truth in arguments under standard situations, and that's a pretty useful feature. It is. I like that feature. All right? But it's only useful assuming you want to avoid coming to false conclusions, right? And if you want to avoid something like that, then logic is something you care about. But how can I argue for you to care about that if you don't already, you know, care about that? Not much else I could say. Now, in this sense of irrationality, there's a lot of non-scientific, non-logical thinking and behavior that is, in this sense, irrational. All right? It doesn't accomplish what people actually want to accomplish in their lives. There's lots of stuff like this. And there's lots of stuff that seems reasonable that may actually be irrational. The beauty of things like decision theory, logic, statistics, evidence-based algorithms is that they can tell us what reasoning methods work and what ones don't, given your goals. For everyday reasoning, for medical contexts, complex experimental physics, we can discover these things. But what should you do if you don't yet know what you're trying to accomplish? If you don't know what you prefer, or you even don't know what you're trying to choose between? Well, the sad but beautiful truth is that no theory of rationality can tell you the right way to figure those things out. Logic and the lot, in fact, are also very bad, perhaps entirely ineffectual on their own, at motivating any action without emotional involvement. Even if I recognize that an argument should convince me, I have to care about it too, and be motivated to follow it before it has any force on me. Logic is going to help me do that. Hence, the great power, but also the great weakness of logical, statistical, empirical, algorithmic methods. They can tell me what I should believe if I know what I want. Yeah? Depending on how much I care about, for example, preserving truth in an argument or making good predictions. They can tell me what I should do given what I want, but they can't tell me what I should want. They can tell me, again, what I should do given what I want, but they can't tell me what I should want, and they can't make me care. Enter imagination. Enter emotion. Enter mystery. Enter magic.
I had a really magical week this week, spending time talking with my dear friend Sam Lacey, our resident psychiatrist, and my older daughter, who lives, has been far away for a long time. I didn't even know that she had a minor in psychoanalytic thought. So, did I say that right? Yeah. Magical thinking is a natural thought process we are all born with. It prevails in infancy and persists into adulthood. Magical thinking is our earliest method of making sense of things around us. In magical minds, we are of prime importance and in control of the world. Magical thinking is a normal activity unless it conflicts with our needs of normalcy or hinders us in becoming who we want to be in the functioning world. Part of growing up is to adjust one's thinking to reality. While magical thinking is something that comes with us from birth. Reality is what our teachers and parents want from us. Irrationality in our actions and much of psychopathology can be ascribed to magical thinking. I'll describe for you some types of magical thinking. Number one, in porous thinking, the sense of the self seems to meld with the environment. Native American peoples, among others, have a very strong sense of connection with the natural world. The Vision Quest experience uses physical stress of food and water deprivation in an isolated natural environment to encourage inspirational revelation. When I'm struggling with an overwhelming problem, I find great comfort in gazing at the starry blanket of the sky in the deep silence of night. My worries shrink and vaporize into the vast blackness. Number two, the idea that coincidences are meaningful. The idea that simultaneous events have some mystical connection. I was in Yee's Grocery this winter and saw a display of kimchi. Then I saw a gigantic Chinese cabbage. And I thought to myself, well, I'll just make some kimchi, although I'd never attempted to do that. That night I checked my neglected email account, and there were messages from my two older daughters, who I haven't seen for many, many months, and hadn't communicated with them, and I found out later they hadn't talked to each other. They both announced they had just made their first batch of kimchi. I took that as a magical sign of our intimate and enduring connections across vast distances, just because it made me feel good. And it might be true. Number three, the idea that contradictory concepts can be compatible. A is true, and also not A is true. My oldest daughter at age 7, when asked what she wanted to be when she grew up, said, a squirrel. And one of my neighbors told me that her son said the exact same thing. In many non-Western cultures, the idea of being human and an animal at the same time is not considered incompatible. I'm frequently inspired in my artwork by this idea. I like depicting contradictions, enigmas, and duplicity, and I often make things that are amalgamations of human, vegetable, insect, or other animal forms. I dreamed recently of having an enjoyable conversation with my father, but my father's been dead for over 20 years. I wondered in my dream how he could be present since I knew he had died, but that didn't diminish my enjoyment of the experience. When my husband Dick was in Nigeria, he was walking with a college-educated Yoruba man who pointed out his deceased grandmother walking through the market at some distance. In Yoruba culture, the recently dead are believed to linger near the living for some time before departing to the next world. You can see them from a distance, but you may not approach them. And actually, Harriet, I've had this intense feeling that Al's presence is around. And, well, maybe you do too. Well, I've had that experience myself too. We often describe another person's attempt to reconcile contradictory behaviors by saying they think they can have their cake and eat it too. An acquaintance who cheated openly and repeatedly on his long-term living girlfriend was dismayed and heartbroken when she left him. Number four, a sense of omnipotence, the idea that your thoughts or actions are responsible for some event. Almost 3 years ago, our dear friend and longtime UU member, Brock Dale, became seriously ill and was moved to hospice care. Brock had asked my daughter, Chloe, and me to come sing to him if he became terminally ill. We went in the early afternoon on a day when the air was stifling, a blinding white hot and with oppressive humidity. We were left all alone with Brock, who was not alert but quietly breathing. Chloe had chosen a song we loved to sing together, I Will Arise and Go to Jesus, for its beautiful harmony. We held Brock's hands as we began to sing. I will arise and go to Jesus. He will embrace me in his arms, in the arms of my dear Savior. Oh, there are 10,000 charms. I will arise, I will arise, go to Jesus. I will arise. Just as our voices blended at the climax, Brock took one wrenching breath, and then he breathed no more. We stood in stunned silence. Eventually, we found ourselves standing in the parking lot. The quality of the air and light had stunningly changed. The air, we both agreed, looked lavender and was fresh and light. It felt like we were in sacred space. We stood there silently for a long while. When at last we spoke, it was to simultaneously wonder if we had precipitated the demise of Brock, who we suspected was an atheist, by singing about Jesus. As we mature, we gradually replace magical thinking with other methods of interpreting our world and internalize magical thinking because it is often deemed unacceptable in our society. We suppress magical thinking until it resides only in our unconscious, which we cannot control. But it still peeks out in our dreams. However, even our dreams are coded in ways that make them almost indecipherable for most people. Interpreting the magical thinking of our unconscious forms the basis of psychoanalysis. In our Western society, magical thinking is considered the territory of the immature, the unsophisticated, or psychotic minds. Children, primitives, and artistic types are thought to have easier access to magical thoughts. However, the conscious or unconscious magical inventions of our minds are deep reservoirs of self-understanding and creativity.
Magic begins in childhood, but hopefully does not end there. Children are born full of enchantment and magic, such as their natural and normal state, but it is a delicate and precarious state and can be fleeting. It is every parent's duty to help nurture their children toward a mature and responsible adulthood while preserving that precious childlike quality of magical enchantment. Most of you have heard of Mary Poppins, I'm sure, and know something about her. She was a British nanny who lived in the early part of the 20th century and who was particularly well qualified to nurture childhood magic. She herself was, of course, full of magic. She could slide up a banister as well as down. She could ride the wind using nothing but an open umbrella. But even Mary Poppins could not protect the twin babies in her care, John and Barbara Banks, from the gradual loss of their original fluency in the language of the birds, the sun, and the wind. It just slipped away. There was a heartbreaking moment when their old friend, the starling, flew in the nursery window for a visit, and he realized that to the babies his voice had forever become a meaningless chirp, that they had forgotten him and that the magic had died. Sylvia and I have three daughters. One of our daughters in particular, Chloe, the youngest, was fluent in the language of the fairies until at least the age of 7. She didn't live in an ordinary neighborhood of houses, grass, trees, parks, gardens, roads, sidewalks. She lived in a magical and enchanted world of fairies, elves, spirits, and what's more, she was the world authority on all aspects of this realm. I remember the sunny spring morning one time she and I took a slow stroll around Manhattan City Park not long after her 7th birthday. As we ambled along, she discoursed expansively on the fairy world all around us. She chattered and lectured nonstop, enthusiastically, tirelessly, for the entire hour of the field trip, and it was a field trip. She was the professor and I was a student. Her knowledge of the fairy world was deep and encyclopedic. She could answer any question I posed about fairies with ease and in detail. She barely paused to draw breath. There was so much to tell. She described the difference between the differences between the grass fairies and the flower fairies and the tree elves, their dress, their habits and personalities, their origin and evolution, their history, art, and culture, their society and government, their interactions with the human race, their favorite colors, the type of magic that was a specialty of each type of fairy or elf. As we walked, she pointed out where the fairies were all over the place. They were hidden in the grass, trees, and plants, unseen but ubiquitous. Every species of tree or variety of flower harbored its own unique race of fairy people. Chloe, you're telling me these fairies are everywhere. I've never seen one. I'm looking. I don't see any. Where are they? How do I know they're there? Dad, I know you're only an adult, but don't you know anything? You can only see them if they want to be seen. Well, I asked her where the fairies came from. She told me the amazing and beautiful story of their origin. To this day, I deeply regret not taking a few days off work, if that had been necessary, to record her disquisition, to write down every word of it, to re-interview her on the topic, to make sure that I didn't miss any details or any aspect of the story. It would have formed the basis of an authoritative monograph on the fairies of Manhattan City Park, and it would have preserved this important body of knowledge for future generations. A 7-year-old child was sparkling and glistening with magic, magic that might have been fleeting, and I didn't have my camera. I don't know whether anyone still living still retains this knowledge, but I urge all young parents to ask their children about it. And if they do happen to be versed in the lore of the Manhattan City Park fairies, please interview them, get it recorded. Mercifully, one small fragment of the story is preserved, but only because our daughter's second grade teacher gave a writing assignment shortly after our fairy walk, and Chloe chose to write on the subject of the origin of the fairies, one of the questions I had asked her on the walk, where did fairies come from? Here is her short story verbatim as she wrote it in her child's pencil scrawl. She entitled it The First Fairy. The First Fairy by Chloe Beeman. Before there were fairies, there were the sun, the moon, the stars, the lightning, and the thunder. The sun had light, magic, and wisdom. The stars had beauty. The lightning had noise, and the thunder had bad noise. The moon had nothing. The sun, the stars, lightning, and thunder were proud of the things they had. They enjoyed looking down on the people in the villages and giving the people the things they wanted. People came to the sun for wisdom, same thing as magic. Blind people came to the sun for sight. Ugly people came to the stars for beauty. People who couldn't talk came to the lightning for voice. If people were so nice it was annoying, they came to the thunder for mischievousness. The moon wanted to have something he could be proud of, too. He wanted the people in the villages to come to him for things. He asked each of the others if he could have a little bit of what they had, except thunder. He was afraid to ask thunder. Each gave him a little. The moon mixed the ingredients up and made the first fairy. The sun's light gave her sight. The sun's magic gave her fairy magic and wisdom. The star's beauty gave her beauty. The lightning's noise gave her voice. The moon asked if they wanted to make fairies for themselves, and they said yes. Each of them took all the ingredients and made their own fairies. That is how the sun fairies, the star fairies, the lightning fairies, and the thunder fairies came to be. All these fairies had sight, magic, wisdom, beauty, and voice, but only the thunder fairies got bad noise. When bad noise went into the new thunder fairies, it became mischievousness. That is why the thunder fairies are mischievous. They're not really bad. That's the end of my daughter's brief note. Magic, same thing as wisdom. Fairies spun from light by a maker who had nothing but the reflected light of others. Just a little taste of what was lost when fairies were forgotten.
I've been both instructed and had to instruct my children on fairies, and I'm not that comfortable with either of them, either of those activities, not as much as Dick here. I remember having a very engaging discussion with a philosopher who almost had me convinced that I should never lie to my kids about anything, not even a little fib, because telling the truth is so important. I heard recounted from people the almost anger they had when they discovered their parents had been lying to them about Santa Claus or whatever. Something about the argument actually started to really ring true, and I didn't buy the conclusion because I thought, no, certainly this couldn't be right because this just seems like such the right thing to do, to have Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy and things like this. But I've got this argument in front of me, and I kind of bought off on the premises, and I kind of, you know, and then all of a sudden it's like, I shouldn't say these things to my kids. It bothered me. And as a philosopher, I felt committed not to just kind of ignore it, but to wrestle with that a little bit. I don't know whether I got the right account or whether I just didn't want to buy the argument and so made something up, but here's what I made up. That telling the truth not lying. It's an ethical command on certain moral theories because of how important the truth is to people's ability to make their own choices. We need to know the truth to decide things for ourselves. This is the basic idea of autonomy, roughly. I'm not so sure that's true. It's not always the truth that's the most important thing for us, for our ability to make our own decisions. Maybe especially for kids, the truth is not even that important. Never mind, maybe I don't have the truth, you know, because, look, you know, some possibility that something's, you know, I believe is false, it could be true. Not enough reason for me to actually say it as if it's true. People have different sort of versions of the truth, things like that. I could kind of mess with that a little bit, and kind of, but that didn't sit right either. But sort of maybe the truth doesn't even matter. Maybe what I'm doing when I'm talking with my kid is not conveying statements that are supposed to be taken to be true or not, but doing something entirely different. So when my kid looks up at me and sort of says, hey, I think I believe in fairies, but I'm not so sure. Dad, do fairies really exist? Yeah. And I've recently found out that some of the city park fairies, they've moved across the street, apparently, because they're all on the south side of Points now as we walk to school. There are little fairy forests. Only little fairies. The bigger ones live somewhere else, but underneath those little sort of weeds, lots of fairies there. Love those walks in the morning.
Can we find magic in the mundane, the familiar, the everyday? Children can. Every day in Manhattan, Kansas, the same daughter I just talked about, Chloe, now only 6 years old, we're going backwards in time, which is perfectly permissible in a magical world, that same daughter gets ready for bed, a very ordinary and familiar routine. She goes into the bathroom, she brushes her teeth, she walks back to her bedroom, she climbs in bed, she falls asleep. But she's still a child. The world is still full of magic and mystery. Every smell, taste, sound, and touch is vibrant, intense, and fresh. Her too big toothbrush feels stiff and bristly in her 6-year-old mouth. She's too little to see herself in the mirror while brushing her teeth. So after brushing, she climbs onto the toilet seat cover, which has one of those cover rugs stretched over it, and leans over to check her work and admire her toothy reflection. She scurries through the menacing darkness of the hallway and jumps into bed. She snuggled under the covers, she sees shadows sweeping across her bedroom walls from the headlights of cars passing down the road outside her window. Now listen to how Chloe herself later described that routine bedtime ritual in a poem, which she entitled Night on the Subway. Standing on the toilet's hairy skin so I could see the mirror, I made sure my teeth were still intact after the large bristled beast had thrashed against their surfaces. I dragged my pearly feet across the silk wood hallway, sinking deeper into black the closer I got to bed, walking faster, then diving into cool cream sheets as summer's curvy wind breathed in and out through my curtains, its lungs. At night, cars drove by. Shadows came out of the walls and skirted just near the edges, forming strange images, passing like strangers' faces on the train. The shadows ran to hide someplace dark as soon as the cars had passed. Sweet alcohol and lilac-flavored perfume came in and kissed me goodnight, singing songs with breath warmer than stars. Her voice bumped and cradled me as though I was sleeping in a subway car as it hugs curves of track. Now I am in the city and the air is hard, light is hard too, and the subway no longer hugs curves. It is violent and out of control, shooting down the tunnel on the verge of calamity. The house stopped shuddering and all the lights died. I sank into dreams and crawled out of my body, climbed onto the walls and marveled with spiders at the size of things through 6-year-old eyes. I became endless moon milk spilled on my sheets, spreading forever until the sun came up to dry me up.
This, I wrote this spring, 87. Concert today was real good.
It was downtown, and lots of people came, including one mystery man I will tell you about. It was about to rain, and during my piece, there was thunder and lots of wind, so my hair was blowing. Also, I wore that purple dress, bad choice. I thought the whole thing was going to fly up. It didn't, though. Mr. Trevor said I had to do a Marilyn Monroe impersonation. The whole thing was wild, the Cachetarian and thunder. I kept having to sort of lean further over for fear of my dress. It was wild, and I didn't mess up. And there was the man standing there. Love me. January 25th, 2004. Dear friends, I finally found a place in Fort Worth that feels like the ocean. I went and lay down on the sloping grass next to the Trinity River today. It was nice to have the slope, as I have a hiatal hernia, and it was nice to have grass, as it is not very often that I lay down on the grass. Anyway, it looked a little steep, so I almost went over to the stairs that everyone else was using, but I decided to walk down by way of grass. Anyway, while you lay there with the nice January sun on you, you hear waves. I-30 makes an extremely convincing sound of waves. It is exactly the right distance away from the river where you just hear this general whooshing sound, a general ocean sound. November 9th, 2004. Dear creators of our Grapes of Wrath, your production was my first performance in Kansas City, and it was one of the two favorites in my life. The other was a high school production of Fiddler on the Roof at North Garland High School in Texas. There are two reasons that that production is still my favorite. Mainly, that is music that I grew up with and still love tremendously. I could play that score every day for the rest of my life and be happy. There was a second reason as well, and that reason was a certain backstage aesthetic that those performers had under their belts, meaning they had it perfected. Let me try to explain. The way I see it, people used to have it harder in some physical ways than we do now. But they also were surrounded by a lot more beauty and inspiration on a regular basis. Think about what it would be like to be surrounded with the daily event of, say, being on or around horses, of not having to travel by metal and vinyl. The last time I rode was this past summer in Utah, surrounded by mountains. Anyway, there was something so beautiful about being with that horse for even just an hour that I can still hold on to that feeling. There is a certain feeling right there that I grasp and re-feel that I can take on stage with me even. I am sure you are familiar with this type of idea. I saw a few of you harnessing such impulses just prior to walking out on stage. Another side of this is that one can watch other performers and take some of that beauty and make it his or her own while entering the stage. The only way this can work, really, though, is to have some mental access to what is happening on stage, to have unobstructed clarity to absorbing what is taking place. In 1890, the Battle of Wounded Knee occurred, and this was a direct happening from the government being afraid of a certain Native American movement that originated in the late 1800s in the Paiute tribe of Nevada. And this movement was called the Millenarian Movement. And the movement was also referred to as the Ghost Dance. And the Native Americans would gather collectively in a kind of a dance. And by doing this, they felt that this would result in the end of the white domination. And by 1890, 65% of the Native Americans in the West were involved in this particular movement. We are a haven for spiritual, intellectual, and emotional growth through honest self-examination, provocative dialogue, enriching experiences, and ever-deepening connections. We are an incubator for the next generation of UUs fostering spiritual and ethical exploration tailored to age and stage, and promoting intergenerational unity. Vibrant, open, and inspirational in what we say and do. We are a bold model of love, compassion, social action, and justice for ourselves, our society, and our planet. We are builders of bridges through our shared humanity and common liberal values. We are a beacon, a visible beacon of hope and meaning within and to our local community.
Why are there so many songs about rainbows, and what's on the other side? Rainbows are visions, but only illusions, and rainbows have nothing to hide. So we've been told, and some choose to believe it. I know they're wrong, wait and see. Someday we'll find it, the rainbow connection, the lovers, the dreamers, and me. Who said that every wish would be heard and answered when wished on the morning star? Somebody thought of that, and someone believed it. Look what it's done so far. What's so amazing that keeps us stargazing? And what do we think we might see? Someday we'll find it, the rainbow connection, the lovers, the dreamers, and me. All of us under its spell, we know that it's probably magic. Oh, have you been half asleep? And have you heard voices? I've heard them calling my name. Is this the sweet sound that called the young sailors? The voice might be one and the same. I've heard it too many times to ignore it. It's something that I'm supposed to be. Someday we'll find it, the rainbow connection, the lovers, the dreamers, and me. Da 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 da.
Magic and knowledge are not contradictory. Understanding of how something works need not take away the magic of the thing, and magical thinking can help us with understanding. Sometimes we need to learn the non-magical causes of things, but sometimes we need to let go and just enjoy the carpet ride. Let's visit over coffee and have a magical Sunday.